Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. Joined with me on the show and in the mental hip, Justin Robert Young.
Hey, friends, it's your old pal, Gerbs.
Brian Brushwood.
Yeah, that's me, but who are you, mysterious host voice?
I am Andrew Main, and I'm the terrified Andrew Main.
As per usual, what is it this time?
It's not snakes. Hey, kiddo, why are you so scared?
I was very worried about a friend of mine.
Oh.
Very worried.
What happened to him?
Well, before we're about to do the show, I got a text message from a friend, one of the people on the show.
Wow.
Not right. Justin,
okay.
Who said, hey, I'm almost in AUS, said that he's almost in AUS, which I'm like, Brian's going to Australia. Oh, no. Doesn't he know about the dangers that lurk there?
The marsupials, they're everywhere.
Brian, so everything, like, creatures. I put this on Twitter. I said, everything in Australia is either poisonous or wants to punch you, okay? And I'm going to send you a link right now, okay? We're just cordoning off the entire continent, folks. We're just dropping a rope all the way around it, out there far enough to include the sharks and stuff. I've got friends headed there right now. The band of magicians is there. I don't know that I'll ever see them again because I just don't think that it's going to be safe. And I'm sorry, guys. I'm going to miss you, but, you know, you went. You made your decision. You went to Australia. So play this video for everybody, Brian, if you can. And Justin, why don't you narrate this as we see it, okay?
Okay. First of all, should I read the headline? No. Here we go.
All right. So this is a koala. Oh, an adorable little koala bear. Back of a vehicle. The koala is just, look at the adorable little koala
it's
bear.
It's like the T-Rex from Jurassic Park chasing the Jeep.
It is, and it's like someone's out mudding in their four-wheeler, and this koala...
It's a little woman.
Get away! Get away! Oh, my God! Yeah, it's coming up on there. Move. Where the bloody hell is it?
Where is it?
Oh, my God, it's a friggin' bike. Piss off! I don't know what I'm going to do now.
Okay.
Describe the scene.
All right, so the koala... All right. Number one, I'm sorry. I didn't know that I should be translating this woman's terror because there clearly is a lot. She was panicked by the fact that this adorable koala bear was chasing after her in the middle of a muddy street. And she gets off and she's like, well, what do we do? I don't know what to do. And the koala bear is on the other end of her four-wheeler,
My favorite part
bike.
Is that
just hugging her wheel.
My favorite part is that, number one, that she's genuinely scared of the koala. But number two, that she clearly has to stop because you don't really see it. You're like, well, why is she stopping? And then all of a sudden it's jumped and it's leapt onto her four-wheeler. She jumps off and then the camera pans and you realize that the reason she had to stop and let the koala bear get on the four-wheeler is because she had run into a herd of cattle that was blocking the road in front of her.
Yeah, some kind of yak jam.
Yak jam.
And it's great because it's like you see it, then you don't see it, and it's this great horror moment. Where did it go? And then pan back, and there's the koala clenching the tire with its fearsome little adorable paws.
And that's the funny part. It's like the punchline is it really did just want to give a hug. It's like, I just want to hug something.
Hi, hello, lady.
So
wait
alone.
For my lady. Hello there, love.
just an amazing accent here.
Oh my God, it's on the freaking bike.
Oh
piss
my God,
off.
It's on the freaking bike. Piss off.
I don't know what I'm going to do.
Piss off, you C word.
We say that a lot here.
Now, they have claws and they have teeth, and you'll hear about people who, like, you know, somebody said on Twitter, like, I had a friend that tried to take one out of, like, got caught up in, like, some plastic and tried to rescue it and clawed. Yeah, they're ferocious. Listen, you can't stay that cuddly and adorable looking in Australia for that long and delicious looking.
Well, it's like,
without having some survival instincts.
Yeah, it's like going to prison, right? I mean, it was a prison colony. And so it's like you got to come out strong, right away. Otherwise, all the other press Australians will think they're weak. All I want to do is look up koala bear attacks now.
So this is, number one, any kind of wild animal, like if you are on the wrong side of their understanding of territory or mating, like they are dangerous.
Yeah.
Like this is that's not a joke. It doesn't matter how cuddly or how much you don't think that they are a dangerous beast.
Oh, jeez.
You know?
And of course they're from nature, so we're looking at a dude who got bit, which means I'm pretty sure this leg later got cut off because there's no way
it's all things there.
Nature can touch you without you dying immediately.
So you think about this: you get a scar on your arm or whatever from a koala, right? You get a scar. And you know, and you're like showing some girl like, oh, yeah, I've got some wounds. And you show her the scar, this horrible thing. And you're thinking of all the disinfectant you had to use, the stitches and the horror. It's like, well, what happened? A koala got me.
See, OK, now here's the trick. Here's the trick is you leave out the koala part and you just say a bear attacked me. I was out in nature and all of a sudden I was the victim of a bear attack.
Oh, no, these people are photographing this koala too close. This woman's too close. No, don't do it.
It's like a found footage horror movie.
Yeah, I can't watch. Something bad's gonna happen.
The spoiler alert. The headline is koala attacks tourist in Australia.
Hey, you might
want to
back up.
Is she
petting it?
They told her to move.
But it's nature and it's pretty. Why would it want to hurt me? Ascending to the top turnbuckle.
He's got that look. He's got that, I'm going to kill me some tourists.
And there's another one up there. There's two koalas on there. They're plotting. One of them just backed down. Just got knocked out of the tree. And now, boom!
It was like they surrounded her. It was like, it was straight out of Jurassic Park. It was like,
clever girl.
You want to back up a little here.
Koalas are no joke, man.
They're kind of a joke.
Everything in Australia wants to kill you and punch you.
I mean, this is clear though that nature abhors us and wants us dead. Like that's
especially
not
Australia.
I'm a bit surprised at how many koala bear attacks.
Oh, this ferocious beast has launched itself onto this poor man's back. Granted, he kind of looks like, the man looks like a koala, so it may be a mating thing.
Yeah.
They're laughing at the man. They're laughing as this ferocious animal tries to murder him.
The guy's got the annoyed look of a principal who just got a pie in the face or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, koala.
So there you have it, folks. Koala bears. We know they're not actually bears. Somebody on Twitter's like, "Koala's not a bear." Well, yeah, you know what? Water bears aren't bears either. Those are tardigrades. But anyhow, just sounds more.
And you know what? Neither the Chicago Bears aren't really bears either. Some of them may be gay. I don't know.
Yeah. Hey, you know the subsection of gay men bears aren't actually bears either.
Yeah. That's amazing. So I did a show last night at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and it was a lot of fun.
In Australia.
In Flaustralia, in Daytona Beach. And it's amazing because, you know, on the way to the gig, they're like, oh, shall we take you by the fleet? And you're like, what? And then they take a left turn on the golf cart. And there is a full-on, like, they have a fleet of airplanes because that's what they do is they teach people to fly, maintain airplanes there. And unfortunately, we had to choose between doing teasers and, you know, hopping in a plane for a quick ride around. So we didn't get to do that. That'll have to be next time. But afterwards, it was interesting because I went out to eat with some of the students and one of the members of the board was saying that she wanted to get into aerospace engineering. And meanwhile, you know, my brain clicks to a fellow SpaceXer, right? Right? That'll be clearly what she's into. And so she, you know, I wait patiently for her to describe, you know, what she likes about, you know, aerospace engineering. And I'm like, yeah, so like you want to work for SpaceX or something? And then she does pinchy face. She goes, And I was like, oh, you don't like SpaceX? And she's like, it's just so boring. And I was like, wait, what? She's like, well, when you design all that stuff, I mean, you might as well just let computers do the whole thing. It's got to be so precise, and you just got and I was like, well, what is it you want to do? And she's like, I just want to make missiles and stuff that blows up. It was amazing because I just got out-meddled with it because I was all excited to share our story of touring SpaceX.
You're like, hey, man, like, we're truly the swashbucklers of science, right? Like, on the cutting edge of exploration. Hey, everybody, like, let's high five in a glorious future. And she's like, yeah, I just want to make death angels.
I want to make weapons.
I want murder tools.
I want you know, my fiery hell to rain from the sky and vanquish our enemies.
Don't care on who.
She saw the terror on my face, and she goes, Brian, do you not know about the koala menace? It must be exterminated. There's a war coming. And it takes place in AUS.
That's a pretty good, like, weapons designer. Is there a job that is more hardcore that pays better?
President of the United States? The button pusher?
Doesn't pay as well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you get speaking fees and stuff.
I mean, right? on paper. And let's only consider when you have the job, right?
Okay.
So obviously president is good when you're not president, right? But in general, you don't really make a whole lot of money as president.
I mean, if you want, like, sexy engineering, it's like, oh, yeah, I designed Ferraris.
Yeah, but it's not as deadly. Not as.
Yeah, but I mean, if I'm going to put one on my Tinder and not the other.
Yeah.
On my Tinder.
How do you think that goes over on a first date? Like, oh, what do you? Oh, you're a librarian. That's very nice. That's very nice. I make missiles that shoot into things and blow up.
Now, so that's either.
Do you think you dance around it? Like, do you just go I'm a aerodynamic hardware specialist.
Yeah, I would imagine it's a bit like it's a bit like, you know. When you work for the CIA and you kill people or help design ways to kill people, it's like, you know, you just put that on Front Street. I imagine you put it on Front Street because it's either going to be, you know, the end of the date right there, which meant it probably wasn't going to happen anyway, or it's an instant closer. You know,
also,
it's like,
if you tell somebody, oh, I work for the CIA and I kill people, I think in general, they'll probably let the date play out, right? And just be like, oh, no, this is great. I guess, you know, I'm real busy, so we might
date. You would say that you work for a consulting firm or a think tank or something else. You're not going to be outright, you know.
You're just like, oh, I do a lot of stuff at Lockheed. I work at Lockheed Martin, you know,
I'm a into space contractor thing.
You know, it's tough.
Project Death Ray.
Anyone who says that they do that, my BS detector would immediately go off because I would assume if you really are that guy, the last thing you do is say it, right?
Yeah.
So is it safe to say that anyone whoever says they work for the CIA kill people is a liar?
Yes, because that's if you're the CIA and you want to hire somebody to kill people, probably the first thing they look for is not somebody who will go out there and say, hey, I work for the CIA and I kill people.
Do you think that's part of their black ops? Is they're like they're swiping right on new recruits' Tinder accounts so they can have first dates where they just probe them for information to see how much they spill?
Or better yet, what they do is they find their Tinder accounts, so they swipe right and add them to a list of just people they want to prank. Where it's like they see someone going out, they're saying it, they're like, hey, bro, we're calling you in. And then it's like, it turns out that it's like they sent him to a McDonald's and like, you got to beat up Grimace, you know, or something. And when they're recording it and live streaming.
It is vital
to the
interest of America that Grimace be beat up.
Do you ever see, I still love this movie, David Mamet, The Spartan?
No, I never saw that.
I seriously dig that movie. It's like, you know, really kind of a slow pace, but kind of cool. The movie in that, like, it takes place with, it's Val Kilmer starts. He's like this special ops guy. And there's this great thing where, like, they're showing, like, how they find the next, you know, like, how they recruit. He gets, like, two guys right off of a base and he puts them in a room. He's like, one of you comes out.
Oh, wow.
He's like, oh, geez, you know.
Man, I'm looking at this is back when Val Kilmer was skinny.
So this is 2004.
Yeah.
It is directed and written by David Mamet.
Wow, I don't know how that one was all the way under my radar.
Yeah, it's a mix. Like, I dug it. Other people are like, meh. I really, really dug it. I thought it was really cool about, like, a Mamet, David Mamet, who I think is an amazing writer and can be a great director, telling a cool story about, like, what would be a more realistic take on, you know, when you watch movies like Taken or things like this. This came out way before, but, like, you know, a guy pulled into that sort of thing. You know, he's supposed to find, like, a kidnapped politician's daughter.
Very cool. Hey, man, do you want to take a quick moment and thank our patrons, and then we could dive into some weird scenarios?
No. You know what? I don't want to thank our patrons. You know what I'm going to tell our patrons to do right now?
What?
I'm going to tell our patrons to go to thecontender.us.
Oh, but I'm so proud of them. We had one request last week. Is keep us in whole numbers, and we still sit here at $666.66. Now, again, for the record, we don't mind going up, but the next tier, we have to jump straight to $7.77, okay?
Yes.
That's the only thing we ask.
that you go to thecontender.us.
/Kickstarter.
/Kickstarter. Kickstarter. Holy cow, congratulations, man. You're barreling.
Oh, 93-420 YOLO swag.
I'll tell you what's impressive to me is not just that you guys, you know, crushed your goal. And by the way, for those of you who don't know, we talked about it last week. But The Contender is a card game in the vein of, you know, your Cards Against Humanity or Apples to Apples, only themed around the political debates that are only going to get more ridiculous over the next, 16 months? How long have we got until... Until this thing calms down.
Yeah, I think it's about 14 months.
14 months? dude. So how does this affect the calculus of how many? I mean, have you guys figured out how many you're going to get printed? Because, I mean, you know, it's not like the Kickstarter ends and then you guys just stop inventing cards and nobody wants to buy it afterwards. It's like then you got the whole round of, you know, the publicity, everything getting out there.
Effectively, you know, we are looking at the game as kind of a year cycle, you know, like to the election, basically. The fact that it's done so well initially is really just a sign that, you know, we want to be a little bit more aggressive with our ordering. I haven't really talked to the other guys. We haven't made any decisions, but... I could imagine that we're probably going to order, you know, several thousand, and then, you know, we just got to see, you know, what else happens. But, you know, we're super excited. Everybody should go ahead and check it out right now. thecontender.us/Kickstarter. And by the way, we are going to sell these base decks on Amazon after the Kickstarter, but now is the only time that you're ever going to get the politically incorrect add-on. That's probably not something that makes a whole lot of sense for us to sell afterward. You know, the base deck is pretty much going to be the thing to do, along with the and also the 2016 expansion. This is the only time that you're going to be able to really get that, because I don't know in what run it would even make sense for us to do those once this is just kind of regular on sale. So check it out and support it. We are on a nationwide campaign this week, the final week of the Kickstarter. We got Meg in New York City. I'm going to be in Seattle. John is here in San Francisco. From sea to shining sea, we are bringing the word to the people for the contender.
Listen, folks, by the time you get this podcast, which will be later today because Bryce is awesome, we're going to have several thousand people listen to this. Thousands of people listen to this podcast, and you guys can push this well over 100K, well over. And Justin doesn't talk about numbers when it comes to money. He talks about backers and just having people support, but I'm going to talk about the cold, hard cash. Get this over 100. This is already on its way to being one of the top-selling card games of all time on Kickstarter. By top-selling, I mean like top 40 or 50. We could push it higher. You guys can make this happen.
We are super excited about it. And you know, we I think we cracked the top 50 games on Kickstarter ever last week, which is insane to think of considering how many amazing games have come out of Kickstarter. And I'll tell you what, I was going through all of the most funded Kickstarters of all time just to kind of see where we ranked. And it was so exciting to see so many friends of ours, including, you know, Jeff Cannata and Corey Coleman, you know, up there on that list. So I'm very excited to have this take off as well as it has.
That's why you need freedom. America needs freedom. Buy the Contender. And if you've heard the Night Attack track, you know what the next part is.
All right, guys.
Show your support.
Changing gears now. There's been a meme that's been circulating around. Have you seen this 104-year-old hipster?
No.
Type in 104 hipster. I've seen it on Facebook and whatever, and people are like this 104-year-old man puts hipsters to shame with his dapper fashions and blah, 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 right?
Wow. that just looks like a guy who's still dressing the way he did as a teenager.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what else about him. He ain't 104.
Ah, boo! No way.
It's like there's no, like, the only thing on there's a Reddit says, I see this guy, like, in the Berlin metro, whatever. And, you know, you just see, like, it's somebody's, I see him there, he dresses different, but the person on the Reddit's like, he ain't 104. And not that I'm going to take Reddit's, you know, a Redditor ran over anybody else, but come on. That guy ain't 104. Ever seen somebody who's 104? They're not holding an iPhone and wearing skinny pants, okay? They look like Yoda, and they're coughing, and they're, like, just curled up, you know, trying to, like, spit on a birthday candle, all right? That is not a 104-year-old man. I don't even think he's in his – I'd be surprised if he was even 80, people,
all
right?
Also, from the – judging from the wire for the earbuds that he's using on his iPhone, which looks to be an iPhone 4, looks like he's wearing Bose – Quiet Comfort 2 headphones.
As so. I have right next to me. Yeah. Right here. Right
Nexcom
here.
Says, Unilad, the number one and final word for age verification, said that he was 104. However, that may not be something that we want to take to the bank. I don't know what the fact-checking department at Unilad really is.
None. It's a thing that keeps being circulated around where we're like, oh, look at this guy. He's the, you know, and it's because people want to believe that he is, but you know, let's look at the credit. There are the number of people who are that age is very, very limited, and there ain't a 104-year-old walking around like that. I'm sorry. I know that it makes warms people's hearts to think that, you know, oh, you know, look at this man, you know, look at it, makes us all feel better to think that, you know, if we just think young and, you know, keep buying our clothes from Forever 21 or Trunk Club or whatever, we're going to look like that.
They will actually be Forever 21.
Yeah,
it says
no.
So in
the title. Truly the key to immortality.
So how let's talk about getting old. Let's put a weird twist on it. Which do you worry about more, the physical breakdown of your body? Because we're getting better and better with making augmentations and improvements. Nowadays, we got robot hips, and used to be you'd go deaf and you'd so, you know, slowly recoil from society because you couldn't understand anything anyone said. Nowadays, we put bionic ears in our face, and then we're able to keep our mental acuity longer because we're all playing Candy Crush Saga for longer amounts of time.
No, we're not. we're not.
but like, how weird is too weird when it comes to augmenting your body to stay alive and sharp? Let's say, you know, I think we're all probably on the same page that if we're losing our mental faculties, that we care less about, you know, living for a long time of being miserable. And, you know, obviously anyone suffering from Alzheimer's and the families of people who have Alzheimer's or you know, obviously progress is being made both on that and Parkinson's or whatever. But there are some quality of life decisions. But barring those, if there are enhancements that pretty much keep you as mentally present, as physically capable as you are right now, how much would be just too weird for you to do? Like,
Brian, I'm going to go full Robo Wang. I don't care.
Okay. So that's what I was getting to.
Let me ask you guys this, because I think we will carry biases that generations after us will not. Let's say limb replacement, like arms and legs, and not because yours don't work, but just as upgrades, you know, well, these, you got a lot of miles on those arms, and eventually they are going to be a problem. So why don't you just get them replaced with robot arms now? Elective robot arms. Yay or nay?
Oh, yay. Yay times yay times yay. I mean, if let's say you get into ultra marathon running and you want to be the best in the world at it, and you realize that once you get past the 150-mile mark, I mean, you have the endurance, you have the willpower and everything, but the problem is your knees, you know, can't function that far. And meanwhile, you're looking at, you know, a recently freed Oscar Pistorius, you know, over there grinning as he scissors past you. I could totally see people going for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's in jail, right?
No, I think he just got out.
Oh, he did? I thought they delayed that.
Yeah, I don't know.
But yeah, your point is taken, Brian. Yeah, I think our audience is pretty much, you know, on the same page here. I mean, we will get exceptions from people who be like, no, but I think
let's not mistake our enthusiasm for like, you want to live for the rest of your life looking different than everybody else because you have legs. And like even if you were really, really, really into ultra marathoning, like, and that was a gigantic amount of what you did, there still is a lot of times in which you are not running ultra marathons, and those are things that will look odd and different. Like, you were going to put yourself apart from other people, you know, for the majority of your life.
Well, let's talk about, man, it makes me think of, you know, Neuromancer stuff, where you got the chick who has like Nikon lens eyes that are permanently, you know,
somebody said robot eyes, but robot eyes, like, you know, when somebody looks into your eyes, they'll probably be able to tell it, but we can already make fairly, you know, realistic looking glass eyes and stuff like that. So it would stand to reason that you probably wouldn't be able to notice it all that much. Robot arm, like if you just have cyber arms, like those are going to look odd if you're just, you know, you're just chilling out and you got Johnny Five arms.
I don't know if it's a case of me being older and more world conscious now, but I remember when I was a kid and I saw somebody with a plastic leg or a plastic arm or a hook arm or whatever, like that deep, or even hearing aids were just disturbing because it was so different and odd. But now, in a world where, you know, we've got this, you know, fairly normalized society of Bluetooth headsets at all time, I think as a society, I don't really look twice when you know, you see someone with, you know, with where it's like they don't even bother to make the prosthetic leg flesh colored because, I mean, number one, because it looks freaking dope, you know, to have, you know, the titanium leg okay, as it is.
But you did how many episodes of Scam School where you had spiky hair? And how many comments in an average Scam School posting were about your spiky hair and how you looked stupid or whatever people were reading into, you know, and yelling about this difference about you?
Why are you bringing this here?
You know, like an adolescent trying to cry for attention, clown-like, bozo-esque. You know, vanilla wafer-colored anteater. And, I mean,
this is actually...
Weak. desperate.
But what's funny is, and you know, I've made no bones about it. Like I reply to people nowadays. I'm like, yes, I have since sold out. I made the world a little less interesting, and you all are clapping. Which it's just so odd for me. It's like I want the world to be more weird and bizarre and insane. I mean, but then again, you know, I'm a total hypocrite because on Night Attack, we'll turn around and say like, ha! The mustache on this guy. Am I right? Oh, I'm look at me. I got a mustache. Might as well put a bullet in my head. I'd rather die than have that mustache.
Wait, what? When did we do this?
I don't know. It might as well. It's a segment I'm pitching for tomorrow.
Oh, okay, good. But I mean, like, do you think that, like, you know, for you, and maybe Scam School is a little bit of a different thing because people are so invested in you. You've created such an amazing community with it. But if you were launching a new show or you were on television, you had, you know, Hacking the System season 2 or another project, and you had a robot arm that you had a lot of really good reasons for wanting to get it, you couldn't help it from being the number one thing
anyway. Well, and let's face it, that's the only reason we even know Oscar Pistorius's name is because he's got, you know, robot scissor legs and ran fast
and it was the whole murder thing.
Well, I thought it came down to like involuntary manslaughter because his story was he thought he was shooting an assailant. that happened to be in the
I don't know enough about it. All I know is that I read it once and I'm like, man, this very much seems like a really weird justice system.
Yeah. Although it is the closest to it is the closest that this real life reality of Earth has come to the Terminator. I'm a killer cyborg. It's terrible.
Probably shouldn't be laughing.
No. No. Yeah.
Hey guys.
Yeah, what's up?
Yeah. Remember we talked about the Hyperloop?
Yeah.
That was cool, wasn't it?
Man, that was just, you know, Elon Musk writes some stuff on the back of a cocktail napkin, goes on Jimmy Kimmel, and he's like, LOL, here it is. High five me, Elon YOLO swag 420. And then just, you know, peaced out. I guess that'll be the last anyone ever heard of it, right?
I mean, I have to assume the harsh reality of legislation, of the government requisitioning of lands and eminent domains and the palms that'll have to be greased. I mean, it just seems like to build all that infrastructure. I mean, that can't be anything more than a pipe dream, right?
Well, guys, you know, when we first talked about it, one of the things we talked about was the limitations and the problems of trying to do a project at that scale. And we had a very U.S. bias to it, you know, and you know, our own problems in trying to put in high-speed rail here, which, you know, probably is a dumb idea. Dramatic pause for a sneeze.
I couldn't.
Sorry, I'm just overcome. Like, there's
your face was that perfect uncanny valley between, oh, here comes the drop, and then like, oh,
I know. I was like, I was getting ready. Like, I thought you were gonna have an epic point. I was at the ready with the.
I do. If we got anything out of True Detective season two, it was underscoring just what a graft, bribe-heavy, crummy, you know,
white.
Just the whole public works projects and stuff like that. You know, oh, we're gonna build this thing, yeah, and a lot of people are gonna get really rich because we're gonna be making your children pay for this thing. But anyhow, point is that other countries that don't have to worry about eminent domain fights and things like that, in China and, like, you know, the Middle East, you know, like some of the places like Dubai and all that, might be interested in this. And you've got two serious contenders now, two firms are competing to turn the Hyperloop into reality.
You know, and I'm really glad, and we discussed this before, but, you know, and you're right. I totally had a U.S.-centric view of the thing, and I thought it was silly and undoable. But you're right. When you've got nothing but, you know, 400 miles of wasteland between, you know, you and the nearest city, it could make sense. Could make a lot of sense. That's awesome.
So, well, you have right now, you have
eminent domain isn't so much of a debatable issue out there. You know, like, hey, we're taking the land. Okay.
So you get to keep your life.
Real quick.
Good news is we're not going to kill you. Also,
so Hyperloop Transportation Technologies has signed deals with vacuum pump business, Orlike and Labeled, Engineers AECOM, and the architectural business Hodgetts and Fung. They're all sort of pulling their efforts together to create a firm in exchange for stock options in the hope that they can create a successful company. This has gone beyond, you know, just planning. They're planning. HGT is hoping to break ground on its first fully working loop at Quay Valley in California in the start of 2016.
So what have we seen in terms of demonstrations on this? I mean, I know last time we talked, there was a talk about like a few mile test track to try it out.
Well, there's another company. There's the Hyperloop Technologies, which is another separate company, has recently broken ground on a 39,000 square foot research facility in Los Angeles. Okay, so what we're having here is these are people spending money, lots and lots of money now, to actually start building the facilities and places to test this out and to try to make this happen.
This is where the rubber meets the road. When moneyed interests, this is why, and you know, we I'm sure there are people out there who, you know, question why we're such cheerleaders for SpaceX. And the answer is because real money is being paid, you know, to make profitable, hopefully, gambles on this kind of stuff. Same thing with was it Space Ventures or what's the asteroid mining one with a bunch of Google folks? Space Ventures.
Google Space Venture. Yeah. Asteroid mining venture backed by Google.
Planetary resources.
There we go. You know, it's like that's when somebody who has a stake in the game pays very smart consultants to, you know, say, yes, this is a gamble, but it's one that will pay off huge. That's amazing. And to hear that with Hyperloop, that's very cool.
Yeah. And, you know, this is early stages, but it is absolutely lots of people taking this seriously, going beyond just the cocktail napkin phase. So that's kind of cool.
I was listening. It's been a while since I tuned into it, but I was listening to the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe before my flight. And one of the things they mentioned was the idea of fusion. There was some research paper that laid out that by intensifying a reasonable amount, the electromagnetic containment of potential for fusion, they figured out a way to on paper do fusion that doesn't have any black box parts of the equation, where it's like, and then we figure out how to solve this part, like on paper everything is doable, and I'm sure it's expensive and there's all kinds of logistic engineering issues that remain to be solved. But what was interesting is they immediately started talking about, you know, we had a space race because, you know, it was a proxy war with Russia, which is why we had all those engineering pushes. Same thing with the Manhattan Project. But, you know, it seems like as they said, the country that can nail fusion all of a sudden has the most valuable product on the planet and becomes the richest country immediately. Do you think there's anything to that, or do you think that that it's too speculative and it's too far out? Because even by the paper, even if they solve all the engineering problems, you're still looking at, you know, 10 to 15 years before we see anything working.
Well, there's a couple factors there. There's a lot of effort being put in, not a lot, but you have a lot of your old school, you know, old school by 20 years ago, Silicon Valley investors are now putting money into things like, I think General Fusion's another company. There's several companies and then some initiatives within bigger ones, like I think GE, et cetera, to build next generation nuclear or fusion plants, rather. I mean, based, you know, ones that actually continuously run. There's a lot of effort in doing this. As far as, you know, does the nation who figures it out? I mean, it's these things, you know, are often multinational projects. These are publicly traded companies in many ways. You know, these are backed by investors from a lot over. I don't think it's so much an us versus them anymore in that regard. And,
yeah,
you know,
that's a good point.
You know, if let's say Chinese people crack this and they want to put them in here, they're going to be working with, you know, partnering with American, you know, companies to whatever to help run it and facilitate it and do that. And so everybody wins. Everybody wins in this scenario.
God, it's so amazing to see how different the world is. That's one of my favorite things if you haven't read it, I'm going to preemptively double down on my pick. Reading Steven Pinker's Better Angels of Our Nature is just life-changing when you see how unprofitable war has become, you know, and how uninterested in the cost of human life humanity has become. And it's, I don't know, in the internet, just in our lifetimes, seeing the whole world shrink to essentially one clubhouse has been amazing.
Well, look at the stocks this week. They're very, they dropped considerably. And part of that is that the fear that the Chinese stock market's been overheated and that they're going to have to slow things down. And, you know, you had people like, we're afraid of this rising China. Well, from an economic point of view, in a rising China means more people to buy American goods. It's why Apple's been doing so well. It's because selling those things in China, selling iPods over there has been great. It's American car manufacturers and all that. With the competition comes the increasing middle class there, which is a global good. More consumers is good. But now that that's, you know.
Well, what is the solution to the very real problem of it is impossible for all, you know, nearly 8 billion of us to consume at a American level of, or Western, you know, level of consumerism?
I don't know that that is true. And what we consume evolves. You know, you look at our use of farmland. We use far less land than we did before in order to feed ourselves. 200 years ago, 98% of the population was involved in agriculture. 98% of the population lived on a farm, worked on a farm. Didn't necessarily own a farm, but worked on agriculture, directly dealing with that. Now it's like 2%, okay? Things change. We have plenty of resources. You know, we've talked on and on about the Julian Simon bet and the fact that we're not running out of these resources. You know, we hear these scares. Oh, we're running out of natural earth elements. Now I live in California. Within 300 miles of me, there's more than enough to last us a century. It's just expensive right now. Oil. We kept talking about peak oil, peak oil, peak oil. Guess what? Nobody talks about, no serious person talks about peak oil anymore. The price of oil has fallen so much because we found so many different kinds of reserves and ways to get it. It's not a motivator anymore. And it's been frustrating for people in the green energy, you know, sector who were hoping at this time that oil would be $100, $200 a barrel. It's not. But the good news is, good news, folks, if you don't like oil and you don't like the idea of putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, prices of solar panels and solar panel efficiencies keep get better, more efficient, and cheaper. By 2030, probably 15 years from now, you're gonna have the serious option of saying, no, do we just do we build more solar plants or not? Apple and Google, who have a lot of money to spare and can blow money away on nice cafeterias and all sorts of other things, can also spend a bunch of money to build solar panels, partially for show, but partially because they see that as the future. We'll eventually all be there.
Well, and I think I like the fact that you brought up that consumption habits changed, because I think the reason that we will, you know, again, we've talked about it before, but abundance is I really enjoyed that book because it talks about the future is brighter than you think. Part of it is, like you say, the cost of energy is just going to get cheaper and cheaper. You know, one of the things, you know, you hear like, we're going to run out of helium. There's only so much helium. And yet in the same breath, we're talking about, well, these fusion reactors will take two hydrogens and make them into helium.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, but even simpler than that, you know, we have an artificially set price for helium because we have helium reserves. And so every time we're pumping natural gas out of the ground, we're getting helium, but it's not worth trying to capture because the price is too low.
Sure, sure.
And then, you know, we got a thing in there. One of our people in the chat room said, hey, I think we should move towards renewables. Well, what is a renewable? You know, in Britain, they're building power plants to burn wood that they're buying from Canada. Is that your future? Is that your future?
Well,
you're importing wood, forests from Canada to burn in a power plant?
We brought this up a while ago. There was some factoid, I forget in which book it was, that it might have been Bold, that said that we have – a man has never, ever run out of a non-renewable resource. However, we have run out of a lot of renewable resources mm-hmm. because of the tragedy of the commons. The perception that, oh, we can always grow more. We can always make more dodo birds. We get, you know, surely the passenger pigeon won't be – or carrier – I forget which pigeon. The pigeon that used to blacken the sky and then we killed them all.
To go back to that British example for a second, I think that's really – just another insidious example of Britain's chimney sweep lobby trying to artificially keep that job around.
But it becomes this idea of we have a mantra, you know, we want renewables. Well, what does that mean? And what are the and that was a mentality that didn't pay attention to, you know, what was going on with the shale revolution and fracking, all these other things. And the good news is, like I said, we're moving towards more solar and stuff as the technology improves. Politicians can't make this thing happen at the speed at which people want it to. You know, science is science. Politics, you know, the great thing I heard is when you put politics and science together, you get politics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what I wanted to bring up is you mentioned that with the consumption habits changing, not only is it a case where things are going to get cheaper because there'll be better ways to, we'll find better alternatives or the best use, or there's a profit motive to make it, as simple as possible. But also at some point, we're seeing an exploding market for virtual goods. You know, we spend more time in front of screens for good or for ill. And as a result, there's unlimited landscapes of worlds you could build. We're sitting here talking about virtual theme parks that you're going to enjoy. You're going to pop on your virtual reality glasses and you're going to get to run around and have adventures, the likes of which, you know, nobody's ever been able to do before. And it will take fewer mineral resources to do so, just more man hour efforts in order to design these worlds. At some point, it's going to be more profitable to take the prize-winning cow from any competition and just clone all its meat and grow it in a lab so that we all get to enjoy the most fantastic steak of all time. And it will take less resources. Yeah, I have no problem with the idea of lab-grown meat, man.
Yeah, so as mentioned in the chat room, Abundance is a great book to read. Check it out. And you know, there are a lot of counter arguments to these things, but read up on that, you know, hear that point of view on it. And there is this perception that when you say, hey, we're pretty good at finding solutions to these problems, and here's a bunch of solutions that are coming our way, there's this knee-jerk reaction to sort of want to go towards the negative space. But, you know, this is something Matt Ridley's talked exhaustively about, and others have pointed out that Ron Bailey has a new book out. 1 second. Hold on.
Uh-oh. Here it comes.
Yeah, if you guys are unfamiliar with the writing of Ron Bailey, do yourself a favor and check him out. I didn't know he had a book out either, but he has been at the forefront of a lot of really rad, kind of left-brain thinking.
So Ron Bailey has a new book, brand new, called The End of Doom. Okay.
Oh, that's great.
And
already a better Fantastic Four movie.
Throughout the past 5 decades, there have been many forecasts of impending environmental doom. These projections have universally been proven wrong. Those who have bet on human resourcefulness, on the other hand, have almost always been correct. So this is a book going through the history of all these things, you know, the cancer epidemics and the idea that the sperm count dropping and all this other stuff. And it's not to say there aren't problems. That's not what he's saying, but he's saying that we have a vested interest often in overhyping these stuff, ignoring human ingenuity, and forgetting when we solved things or figuring how or why we solved them, because there is a almost religious belief that people have that, you know, that we're sinners and that nature's punishing us and that we must be punished.
Well, I wonder if at some level it's it's just built into us the same way that we're, you know, afraid of snakes or whatever. It seems like the tribe that's constantly terrified of being wiped out maybe is a little more vigilant and has a tendency to procreate more than the tribe that, decides it's all good. We'll figure it out.
It depends if they spend all their time building statues on their island instead of cultivating crops, and then all of a sudden they wither away, you know. And we've seen many instances of ancient civilizations or civilizations facing changing environment, changing cataclysms, and all of a sudden decide that what they really need to do is pray to the gods, you know, or do these sacrifices or do these things that are not going to help. So Ronald Bailey's book, The End of Doom, Bailey, if you go check him out, his blog, he's been publishing all of the big high profile criticisms or reviews of his, even when they're critical of him. So you can check out that. It's reasoned, I think.
I mean, say what you will about the slaughter of children daily by the Aztecs, but at least the sun rose on time every single day. They never missed it, man.
That's a good point, Brian, you know.
I remember I saw Ronald Bailey speak once, and he was the first person that kind of opened my eyes to the idea of like, all right, so I'm going to attempt to very briefly get into this and then immediately get out, because it's a conversation that is very, very deep and complex and can go for a long time. But when it comes to the concept of global warming, or, let's take away man-made or natural, however you want to classify it, he was like, well, look at all these ideas on how we can cool the Earth, up to and including gigantic satellites that just take and reflect sunlight in a certain way. Like there's a million different ideas of things that we can do that can change our world for this situation. It just totally turned a light on in my head. Instead of this very binary, like you said, when you mix science and politics, you get politics. This like, oh, well, it needs to be this or it needs to be this. And you have two options. So pick one and then stab your neighbor if he doesn't think that it's the right one. Like, he's like, no, what about crazy space satellites? Like, how about we think about how we've solved every problem that has ever faced humanity by sciencing and engineering our way out of it.
And you get this, you know, this, the, well, what if we just cut back on what we're doing? Like, yeah, what if Detroit stops murdering people? You know, what if that, Well, no, we should have legislation. What if they pass a law that says you can't do this, you know? And it's you know, we are you have to count on us being self-interested because that's how we've survived. That is why we exist as a species. And then you have to figure out how does that self-interest help and align with everybody else and what's the best path.
Well, and that's the funny part is we can there is no conflict of interest in saying that we are, can, and should continue to be completely self-interested. Also, by the way, the things we're interested in is a happy, healthy, diverse, biologically stable, long-term lasting environment on mm-hmm. this and on other planets, which
better technologies to get our energy from, you know, all for it. I know why we're here. You know, we understand why we're at this point. And why it's not this, you know, and then, you know, I'll hear people like, oh, well, if we just spend this or do this. And it's like, well, if we take that approach, it's not going to have the outcome you want. And it's going to make people very, very poor. And, you know, 4 million people die a year from indoor smoke from having to burn wood because they don't have access to electricity. 4 million people die a year on this planet because of indoor air pollution because they can't flip on a switch like we can and have power and heat and light.
Again, another example of the insidious
chimney sweep lobby
that kills 4 million people a year. The blood's on your hand. Chim murderers, the all of you.
That's right.
That's let's not make light of the 4 million deaths.
Gentlemen, should we jump into picks?
Yeah, man. I already mentioned abundance, and I guess I'm going to have to read The End of Doom. While you just showed that off, I took a peek, and unfortunately it's not on Audible. Did we get a chance to discuss last week? My pick was Aurora by Kim Stanley Robinson, but I don't think you were here to discuss it. Did I talk to you about this at all, Andrew?
We mentioned Aurora.
Okay, so it must have been 2 weeks ago then.
Yeah, last week.
Wait, was it 2 weeks ago that we were sans? 2 weeks
ago, yeah. Tom was here in Andrew's stead.
That was 2 weeks ago. Okay, sorry. At any rate, that directly ties into if you enjoyed the discussion of how to handle ecological problems of a global nature in terms of it is a surprisingly pessimistic take on it from the guy who wrote a sprawling trilogy about colonizing Mars. And I on purpose didn't mention any details last time, but now I figure you've had some time to start it if you're going to start it. But shockingly pessimistic. If you want to believe that we're probably going to hell in a handbasket, then Aurora might be a good book to read.
Well, I mean, that Kim Stanley Robinson is a great writer, but he comes from a way out there political point of view and all that too.
Well, but it's funny because I thought that in general, the Mars trilogy was extremely optimistic about our chances to be able to terraform another place, and you know that's one of in the Mars trilogy, they build a soleta, you know, an array of mirrors to reflect more sunlight so that essentially the sun is as bright on Mars as it is on Earth. And then, you know, they just fix it. They science away all the problems. Whereas Aurora recognizes that some problems suffer from zoo syndrome and can't quite be scienced away, or at least in this scenario. It's a fascinating read. But yeah, I'm going to double down on basically stuff I said before because I haven't read anything else new.
Sweet.
Cool.
I'm going to go back and point out The End of Doom. And one of the things I love about Ron Bailey is that he is, as a journalist, you can go to Reason.com and find a lot of his articles there. He's a guy that covers the environmental debate very, very heavily, and he's come from one point of view, and he's not one of these people who's like, no, you know, let's keep pumping up as much CO2 as we can or whatever. Like, you know, he's not that, you know, he's not. And that's, it's very easy in this discussion for people to decide that you're either one camp or you're the other camp. And there's a lot of people going, no, we need to approach these things individually. But he points out the IPCC reports, which is like kind of the organization that puts together the UN report on climate change. What's changed in the last one since the one before that? What have they backtracked on? There have been a number of things, these very, very dire things they said were going to happen. They're now like, you know what? The evidence doesn't support that, but you'll still hear people say, oh, yeah, this is going to happen or this isn't happen. Not that it's like all, you know, happy, happy, happy news, but it's this, if you look into the science, which he does, he says, no, the people who worried about this, they're not as worried about this thing or whatever. So anyhow, Highly recommend Ron. Highly recommend The End of Doom by Ron Bailey.
What about you, Justin?
I think I shouted this out when I first started watching it, but I finished it, and I was really excited that it was very, very, very good. This is Wet Hot American Summer, First Day of Camp
on Netflix.
I've started watching it, and it's one that Bonnie didn't like. You know, I watched the first couple without Bonnie, and it's one of those, you know, helicopter Bonnie finds herself kind of watching and just catches the right funny moment. And it's become a regular jam for us. But we find that it's so dense and so good that we can't watch more than one. It's not like Orange is the New Black where you just burn through them and who cares. It's like each one is so dense that we get our fill just 30 minutes at a time and then wait for it.
It's so dense. Every frame. I have very often called the whatever this entertainment age we are in, where we are very content to just keep bringing the things we loved from the past, you know, drag them into the pet cemetery of Netflix and Hulu, and then just be very excited when whatever emerges from their grave is back to play with us once more.
Explain to them what this is for people who I did not see Wet Hot American Summer, the movie, until maybe 3 or 4 months ago.
I still have not seen it, and I don't care. I Bonnie and I both worked at a summer camp, and so we got enough of our nostalgia bomb for, you know, the times that that's camp.
So Wet Hot American Summer was a movie that came out, I believe, in 2000. An independent movie with a cast that now is kind of considered star-studded, was not necessarily at the time, including Paul Rudd, Bradley Cooper,
Bradley
Maloney,
Cooper's first movie out of college. It was like Amy Poehler's like first movie, you know, like, yeah, these people, the first thing they ever did was this.
Yeah, no, this was, yeah, it was Amy Poehler almost pretty much right out of the Upright Citizens Brigade TV show on Comedy Central, and really the heart of the cast and the creative team was the cast in of The State, and David Wayne and Michael Showalter, who wrote the movie and are the main stars. You know, 15 years goes by. They've joked about doing a sequel, and apparently wrote a sequel as a movie. And then in this climate of people, you know, with a lot of money that want to bring back established properties, Netflix gives them the money to do a limited series of, I think it's 6 episodes. No, 8 episodes, sorry. Eight 20-minute episodes. But it's so funny, and it is exceptional. And it is one of those things that, between the fact that it's you know, this great deconstruction of what a prequel is, and the idea of, you know, making overstuffing a plot and having every little second have significance. It's very, very well done. It's very funny. The cast is extraordinarily talented, and nobody's really mailing it in. And especially considering how difficult it had to be to get all the cast together, it doesn't suffer from the Arrested Development problem with their season on Netflix, where it felt really weird to have these characters apart from each other. There's a lot of really good plot reasons why people are kind of separated. There's one bit about one of the more famous cast members. They find a very funny way to illustrate why he's obviously wasn't there to shoot, you know, one gigantic group scene, which is really
fun. It's the movie. Go back and I would say go watch the movie first, which is on Netflix. Yep. Wet Hot American Summer. And it just, you think, what an amazing, you know, every now and then you see a movie that has an exceptional cast of, you take like, say, Dazed and Confused, of just up and comers, you know, where people who went on to such great things. And the first one, you've got, you know, you got Bradley Cooper, you know, Rocky the Raccoon, you know, Rocket Raccoon, you know, who's all his other success. You've got Paul Rudd, Ant-Man. You've got, you know, Christopher Maloney. You know, I mean, it just goes on and on. And then for the first day of camp, they brought in people where it's not just the existing cast they're able to bring in. They bring in, you know, other people like Jason Schwartzman, Lake Bell, They've got John Slattery in a great role. I mean, just the incorporation of all of that. And they brilliantly said, okay, Wet Hot American Summer takes place, and then this is the prequel. So Wet Hot American Summer, you had a bunch of 30-year-olds playing like they're 15 and 16. So Wet Hot American Summer, first day at camp, you have a bunch of 40-year-olds playing like they're 15-year-olds. And the way they try to explain away certain things and stuff, like Elizabeth Banks' character and all that, is just incredible.
Well, I especially enjoyed the moment that a young girl enters womanhood and emerges from the bathroom stall, clearly in her 40s.
John Hamm.
Oh, yeah, dude. And again, John Hamm, maybe one of my all-time favorite comedians now. This guy, I don't understand how he ever played a serious role in his life because he's so good.
Well, by the way, I mean, it has a core of the cast of Mad Men in this series. You know, John Slattery, John Hamm, and Rich Summer, I believe, is one of the evil Camp Tiger Claw lackeys. Kristen Wiig is in this. She has like, you know, four or five lines, but they're all really funny. Michael Cera is in it in a role that, like, yeah. I want to see that Michael Cera more often, because I think him in this, he plays effectively this oddball lawyer character, but it's just really well done.
Hey, it did occur to me, I guess my picks were all, it did occur to me that I did see something new. I burned through like four episodes of Mr. Robot to get fully caught up, and holy cow, if you guys aren't watching it, Mr. Robot is so good. It really, the very first episode, I thought, holy crap, this is Fight Club, the TV series, in terms of its tone, its unreliable narrator, its anti-establishment message and all that. You have a character, and, you know, I don't think it's a surprise to know that there'll be surprises, but the surprises as they are coming from very clever angles that all of a sudden recast entire interactions that have been under your nose. You know, that's all I'm going to say. It's great. If you haven't watched it, watch Mr. Robot. Mr. Robot. Might be my favorite TV show of all year.
Cool. Sweet. Maybe I'll talk about it later. I've been watching The Flash, really digging The Flash.
People say really good things. They say it started off a little slow, ironically, but then it really picks up.
It's, you know, we're in a age where you can make a comic book movie on TV and have great special TV, you know, TV level special effects and stuff. And, you know, and the writers of it kind of get, you know, what's the limitation of The Flash. And it's got, you know, kind of the CW-y sort of, you know, formula to it, but it's the best version we've seen of it yet. So I'm excited about that. And when they do Legends of Tomorrow, you seen the trailer for that?
No, not at all.
Legends of Tomorrow. Oh, okay. Check this out.
Yeah. TV Avengers.
Yeah.
It's, oh, wow.
It's, yeah. It's worth checking out. Maybe we'll do that right after we say it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.